Well, we don't normally stir up controversy with our guest, and I don't expect to today, but we do have Jack Curtis, who's CEO of Corporate Health Partners based right here in Atlanta. CHP provides comprehensive, systematic wellness programming featuring engaging face-to-face health coaching for employers at the worksite. Jack founded CHP in Nashville in 2002, and after previously serving as president of Life Signs and general manager of a Berkshire Hathaway business. Jack's a longtime member of the Hero Think Tank. We talk about Hero quite often on the show. We're a well-respected organization. It stands for Health Enhancement Research Organization. It really is composed of thought leaders among employers and providers engaged in population health management. Jack, in addition to being a member of Hero, serves as a chair of their leadership committee. And he's also a member of the League of Leaders, and that's a guide for the Institute for Healthcare Consumerism. Jack's got a BS degree in biomedical engineering from the University of Tennessee, later earned an MS in engineering management from the University of Tennessee, and it would be interesting to hear his career flow into Corporate Health Partners. Jack, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me today. I appreciate it.
So, yes, I'm very interested.
Let's start there.
That you're an engineer, and now you're a hero in the area of health improvement.
Good one, Dave. Good one. I like that. Yes.
Yeah.
Actually, how did that happen?
Actually, when I went to school, I was intrigued by biomedical engineering and had a unique opportunity to do a co-op education program at NASA. And it was fascinating. It was a great time to be there, met the astronauts, and was involved in instrumenting them during their training when they were training for spacewalks. So it was a great time in my career. But as I graduated, NASA started downsizing, and weren't opportunities there, weren't opportunities for biomedical engineering anywhere I wanted to live in the South. So I went into traditional engineering, climbed the ladder, engineering management, quality management, general management, and then finally got the chance to get back into healthcare with Life Signs.
Interesting. Very good. I would love to know some astronauts. I think those are the heroes. Those are the real heroes of my generation.
Absolutely. It was a great honor to meet those.
Mm-hmm. Totally agree. So, Jack, tell us about Corporate Health Partners, its services that you provide. Can you give us an overview?
Yeah, I mean, the description that you read earlier was very fitting. We do program management and face-to-face health coaching for employers in that middle market that you described that's served by our sponsor today. So, and basically, they outsource the wellness program to us. In a nutshell, we try to build a best practice program.
Now, why face-to-face? Because I do think that is a unique value proposition you bring to the table.
Yeah, and it goes back to a little bit of our history. When I founded the company in 2002, telephonic coaching was the only thing available. The industry had grown up around serving the jumbo employers who had work sites all across the country and the world, for that matter. And the only way to serve all those work sites effectively was with virtual programming. So HRA, portals, newsletters to the home through the mail, and telephonic coaching. And at the time, we decided to bring the jumbo employer solutions to the middle market and just partner with those. And, we knew behavior change took a while. And we didn't expect results the first year. And basically, we were doing three-year deals. And by the time we were 3 years into a contract, we were saying, well, these results aren't really what we had hoped they would be and what the employers, our clients, were hoping for. So we started scratching our heads, what are we missing here? And the virtual programs were attractive because HR could just say, give me a paycheck and eligibility file and check, I've got a wellness program. But to the employees, at best, it seemed like an event. If they did a screening, and it didn't seem like a program, and it certainly didn't seem like a culture change. And that's how we learned that, I really have to go to the work site, you have to roll up your sleeves, you have to get involved with employees and the practices at the work site to have a sustainable environment to make the health coaching work.
But the biggest barrier that I see is obviously, particularly in the small market and midsize, so is the budget, because you're talking about now a dedicated resource on site. And how do you talk or convince companies that that's the way to go when you're talking about a budget that's probably 10 times more than the previous conventional model?
It's a great point, and it definitely comes up all the time. And I would say, number one, we try to make it affordable where, the jumbo employer solutions, they have somebody on site full-time, sometimes a team of people full-time. And in the middle market, they just can't justify that. So we'll send somebody a few hours a week if need be to have a sustainable, focused effort on a program. So keeping it affordable is one part. But the other part is setting reasonable expectations. And I do it two ways. Because it's not inexpensive to go to the work site and be hands-on and manage the program and do face-to-face coaching. So one way to look at it is if your healthcare costs are running $10,000 per employee per year and they're going up 10% a year, that's a $1,000 increase per employee per year. And if you want to knock that trend down, if you want to flatten it and you expect even a 2-to-1 ROI on the wellness program, you need to be investing $500 per employee per year. Flu shots and water bottles and posters just won't knock down a serious trend like that. So that's the kind of investment that needs to be made. It's just the math.
Mm-hmm.
The other way, there's another way to look at it. The other is, as a nation, we spend less than 5% of the total, all the trillions that's spent on healthcare, on prevention. And I say employers need to be spending at least that much because they get the productivity gains as well. And 5% of that $10,000 figure is still $500 per employee per year.
Yeah.
So describe a role of a coach. What are their responsibilities there at the work site?
If they haven't started a wellness program, and these days most people have, but they haven't started, form a wellness team. Who are the well-connected, well-respected people, cross-section from different departments to be great representatives and champions on the team. Form the team, train them, plan a calendar of events, set objectives and goals, plan year-round health promotion, challenges, classes, tying into community health events, promoting what's in the program from all the different vendors, whether it's EAP, disability management, disease management, and the health plan, so that all of those things are integrated and promoted, because often our coaches have time to promote those things where the HR folks don't. So getting that fundamental foundation of that creates that supportive environment is number one. But often we also get the opportunity to do the face-to-face health coaching at the work site, and I feel like that's the most effective way to do it, because it's not just whenever you have a scheduled coaching session that you have a touch point. You see them after the lunch and learn. You see them at the weigh-in. You see them at the 5K race. And so there are many more opportunities to help keep the participants on track.
You know, that you just commented on several different ways in which the coach can interact with the employee, many different touch points. And that may have answered a question I was going to ask you today. In medicine, there's a huge growth in the telemedicine arena, where we have Teladoc and MD Live and American Well, and almost all of the major carriers now have telemedicine providers that they've contracted with. And I wondered if the wellness coaching business has considered using the Skype-like chat feature that medicine is now adopting.
Absolutely. I think it's got tremendous potential. We've done some, I'll call it unofficial coaching through that means, but the trick is it's got to be HIPAA compliant. And so a lot of the hurdles that the Teladoc kind of companies have had to go through is making sure it's compliant, the encryption, and making sure that's secure. And although our information might not be quite as sensitive, mm-hmm. it's still sensitive. It's still personal health information. So we'll need to make sure and get that right. But in terms of the rapport that can be established, just face-to-face, I think it's the way we're wired. It just works better than a faceless opportunity over the phone.
And, you know, I think that's almost we all know that. Intuitively, we know that. Face-to-face is always better than telephonic. Mm-hmm. And certainly the studies in the disease management realm, which is primarily done telephonically, have been abysmal. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it probably takes a special person to be able not only to be a behavior change coach, but also to help administrate programming and such. So what characteristics do you find help with your crew?
Well, besides the kind of obvious about, you know, having a bachelor's in some field in health sciences, exercise science, exercise physiology, nutrition, something like that as a basis. I mean, we look, number one, they need to be passionate about making a difference. And I think our folks would work for free if they could, just to make a difference in people's lives. They feel very strongly about what they do, very connected, and I think that makes the model very effective.
Mm-hmm. We had in our corporation, we recently had a lecture that discussed the various differences between the generations, the millennials, the Gen Xs, the baby boomers, et cetera. And I found it interesting to note that one of the major characteristics of millennials, these 26 to 33-year-olds, or if I have that right, was that they wanted their work to be socially conscious. They wanted to make a difference. That was extremely important to them. So I imagine mm-hmm. you're hiring a lot of young coaches.
Yes, we do. But actually, there's a trade-off there. There are a lot of coaches coming out of college these days that are very well trained, and they're so anxious and so passionate and want to make a difference, and we'd love to hire them. The problem is when they get out in the workforce and think about it, if you're middle-aged and you've been married, maybe even divorced, you've been through a bankruptcy, you got two jobs and so forth, you know, how are these kids right out of school going to relate to me?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, they like to have a few years on a coach so that they can relate to what's being said.
Yeah, I can understand that. I had a full beard the first 10 years of my family practice medicine career.
Did you?
I did.
Oh,
I had to look older than my patients.
That's interesting. Yeah. So are there specific coaching certifications that you look for when looking at staff with it? Are there organizations and certificates that stand out more than another?
There are several that are out there, and I won't call names, but there are several good ones that are out there now. But we look for people that have, you know, experience in some kind of teaching, whether it's classes, one-on-ones, a personal trainer, and these coaching certifications. But the most important is the training that we do, that we've kind of learned from experience after they're hired.
Mm-hmm. So tell us a little bit about that. So how extensive is it? What type of training do you actually do to make sure that they're staying, what, fresh, up to date, and understanding, or at least sharing, I'm thinking, among your organization and personnel?
No, you're exactly right. I mean, to your earlier point, we make sure that we hire good people first that have a good, sound understanding of the science, not only the science of nutrition and activity mm-hmm. and so forth, but also training and behavior modification. And then we spend time with them days after that about what actually happens in a coaching session, and whether it's looking at Prochaska's stages of readiness to change or motivational interviewing and all those things, and how do you know what to use and how they work together and that kind of thing. But to your second point, we have ongoing continuing education, and all of our coaches meet together, and they're all sharing what they're learning, like you did on the program, with what's new on the market, what just came out, what do we think about that, what's been our experience relative to that. So they're all sharing amongst each other as we go.
Mm-hmm. You know, in the field that we work in, which is primarily the middle market, we're talking about corporations between 100 employees to 5,000 primarily. We stress to our clients that the ROI is not the measurement to look for in your size segment, but there are measures that are important. So how does CHP gauge your success? What are the metrics that you would follow?
Great question. We share those concerns. Certainly, if you don't have the law of large numbers working for you, all the good that we do in health promotion and prevention side can be overcome with things that aren't, that you can't do anything about, the premature twins or the genetic issues. So, you know, we try to deal with what we can make a difference, and that's risk reduction. And you can measure that to some degree with the health risk assessment, but that's self-reported. And so with some people that holds more water than others, we look at the biometric level. So what are the cholesterol, glucose, blood pressure, body mass index and waist circumference where BMI falls short sometimes. So what are those key measures, and are we making a difference there? And although I agree with what you're saying, ROI from a real, you know, looking at health claims, we look at some of the national databases, whether it's Eddington's or the HERO database, and look at what's the theoretical cost associated with risk reduction, and you can look then at, are mm-hmm. you making a difference and are you paying for yourself?
Yep, got it. Okay. Mm-hmm.
So I want to keep going on that topic of measurables and realistic impact of it. So I would think that, you know, a company invested in a 40-hour per week coach or on-site person as opposed to 10-hour a week produces better success. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely.
Okay. All right. And so then what level of success would be an expectation then? Or maybe better, Jack, just to say, what six levels of success have you seen from a range standpoint to be able to get companies to buy in and agree that the program's making an impact?
Great question. You know, let me go back to the point you made earlier about the risk reduction. So, you know, we're seeing that risk reduction, and that's actually in the first year. We see significant between the baseline screening when we start with a client and then another screening a year later. We see significant risk reduction such that it's you know, paying for itself within that year. And we don't see that if we're just on site promoting challenges and classes. We don't see that kind of risk reduction, but where we're doing the coaching, we do. It's like mashing your foot on the accelerator to get those results in that first year when you have health coaching. And I'll relate back to a study Seth Sirkshner did years ago that people participants in a wellness program are up to 350% more likely to drop a bad habit for a good one with the help of a health coach. And now we know how to make that sustainable with the working on a supportive environment.
Mm-hmm. And I would think sustainable is the right message to look at, because, again, I think it's important to be looking at the health of the whole population, not only those with high risk, but those with low risk, and sustaining that they're staying in that bucket to be able to do that so that the overall change or net change of the organization is a continual decrease of overall risk, right? Is that kind of the picture you try to look at?
Exactly, or at least don't get worse. And D. Eddington's, you know, zero trends. Don't let it get worse.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
All right, so I'm not going to let you out of the studio today until I hear your viewpoint on incentives, because you know the hardest thing that we have with many of our clients is getting the membership engaged. So, what's your viewpoint on the best types of incentives an organization can use?
Great question. Ultimately, you'd want people to do it because it's the right thing. But if you go in with that assumption that people will do it because it's the right thing, you get a bell curve response. You get people 10 or 20% on one end that will do anything you offer them to be healthy. Without incentive, they'll do it. You have 10 or 20% at the other end of that bell curve that won't do it no matter what you do. Some of them would leave the company before they would engage. And then in between, you've got the people you can sway with good communications, as that earlier news article said, or good mm-hmm. leadership, but last but not least, it's incentives. And I find in the middle market that it takes incentives to get people to try it. And I look at it like, all right, we got the clock ticking. It takes significant incentives, and I'm talking somewhere between $50 and $100 per employee per month usually to get the majority of the workforce engaged, which then means you've got all risk stratification engaged. So, but then the clock's ticking. And then it's up to the programming and the coaches or whatever other resources are involved in the program to get the participants to internalize it and do it, because then I feel better. I look better. You know, I'm making a difference. I'm more focused. I can remember. I can get up off the floor when I get down to play with the kids. So at some point, they need to internalize it to really make it sustainable. And you mentioned HERO earlier. I remember going to a presentation years ago. Johnson & Johnson and some of those big employers that have been doing human capital for a while with a heavy dose of wellness don't use incentives, but mm-hmm. it's part of their culture, and they've been working on it for decades.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you find
is that a good answer, Dave?
That's a good answer. Okay. We'll take that.
Do you find companies What percent do you find are using participatory incentives and outcomes-based incentives?
That is a very hot trend. I would say we're looking at maybe 20-25% of our client base are using outcomes-based now, and the trend is going that direction. And certainly in the work in HERO, that's been the hottest thing that's come out since I've been in the HERO think tank. Mm-hmm. Just it resonates with CEOs and CFOs because they feel like that's getting everybody aligned. It's like the safe driver discount comes to health insurance.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I haven't heard that analogy before. I like that. Mm-hmm. Safe driver discount.
Mm-hmm.
Good.
Yeah.
All right. Well, it's about time to wrap up.
Let's ask him the question.
Let's ask him. Go ahead.
All right, Jack. We always finish our interview by asking our guests the same question, trying to get the best of responses here. And so that is, what do you feel is the most successful engagement strategy to get members to participate in health improvement programs?
You got to pick one, just one.
No, you don't.
Well, leadership, because everything else comes from that. You know, the culture comes from that. The budget comes from that. The messaging comes from that. So I'd pick leadership.
All right. So I'm going to have to extend that answer a little bit. So when you say leadership, who...
I thought you said just one, Steve.
Well, this is part B. What leadership?
Whoever the person is in charge, the CEO or the county manager or the mayor or whoever's leading the charge.
It's from the top.
From mm-hmm. the top. And you can't leave out the middle management. I mean, if you... at some point, they've got to pick up the charge.
There you go. See,
that's right. Yep, I agree. I think 30% of their merit increase should be based on the achievement of their wellness goals.
I know.
Wouldn't that be awesome?
We've got to come up with a model, though, that we can present to demonstrate that.
Every time we suggest that to the HR department, they fight us.
Well, I know, because they immediately reflect the barriers that they know they're going to face and get thrown back out at them. And so we've got to come up with a bullet point list that tells them, that takes them through that process. If they question this, here's your response for that. You know, how does a middle manager fight the whole issue of not learning too much about an employee's personal health information, trying to do that, those type of things. But I think I agree. We need to do a whole show on that as well. All right, Jack, so we want to thank you for being on the show today. How can people find out more about Corporate Health Partners?
Go to our website at www.chp-inc.com.
All right. So, okay.
Jack, that's great. Thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
It's been fun.
It has.